Jasodha Nandana Mraja Janaranjana Jamuna Tiravana Chari Jaya Radha Madhava Kunja Bihari Jaya Radha Madhava Kunja Bihari Jayam Vishnupada Paramahamsa Parivraj Gacharyasha Purushata Shushima Stavayan Grishula Prabhupada Ki Jai Grantaraj Shima Bhavatam Ki Jai Gaur Primanandi All glories to this among the devotees All glories to Shri Shri Guru and Gauranga Om Aknanant Mirandasya Gananjana Shalakaya Chakshuru Militam Yena Tasmai Shri Guruve Namaha Shri Chaitanya Mano Bhishtam Stapitam yena bhutale swayam rupakadamayam dadati svapadantikam Vanchakalputurubhyascha kripasindubhyarevacha patitanam pavanebhyo vaishnavebhyo namo namaha Jaya Shri Krishna Chaitanya Prabhu Nityananda Shri Advaita Gadarha Shri Vasari Gaura Bhakta Vrinda Hare Krishna, Hare Krishna, Krishna Krishna, Hare Hare, Hare Rama, Rama Rama, Hare Hare, O Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya. O Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya. O Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya. Srimad Bhagavatam, Canto 7, Chapter 5, starting with text 25. Translation: After hearing these words of devotional service from the mouth of his son Prahlad, he heard, what is the best of all things you've learned? Prahlad at school. And Prahlad Maharaj said, hearing chanting about Vishnu. And now we're going to hear Hiranyakashipu become furious. So after hearing these words of devotional service from the mouth of his son Prahlad, Hiranyakashipu was extremely angry. His lips trembling, he spoke as follows to Shanda, the son of his guru, Shukracharya, in the verse on the board. Brahma bandho kimetate vipaksham shayata sata asaram grahito bhalo mama nadritta durmate. Word to word meaning Brahma bandho. O unqualified son of a Brahmin, Kim etat, what is this? What is this? Te, by you, vipaksham, the party of my enemies, shayata, taking shelter of, asata, most mischievous, asaram, nonsense. Grahita, tat, balahu, the boy, mam, me, anadritya, not caring for, durmate, O foolish teacher. Translation and purport by Srila Prabhupada Ki Jai. Translation, O unqualified, most heinous son of a Brahmin. You have disobeyed my order. 마음 안아들어 두르마테. You have disobeyed my order and taken shelter of the party of my enemies, vipaksham. You have taught this poor boy about devotional service, asaram garhito bhalo. You have taught this poor boy that which is asaram. Asaram means useless. You have taught this boy about devotional service. What is this nonsense? Shayata asata. Purport by Srila Prabhupada. In this verse, the word asaram, meaning having no substance, is significant. For a demon, there is no substance in the process of devotional service. But to a devotee, devotional service is the only essential factor in life. Since Hiranyakashipu did not like devotional service, the essence of life, he chastised Prahlada Maharaj's teachers with harsh words. So Hiranyakashipu has become extremely angry, thinking that the teachers have taught Prahlada Maharaj about devotional service, which was strictly against his order to not do so. So he's chastising Shande here, one of the teachers, one of the sons of Shukracharya. And he's saying, why have you taught this poor boy, grahito bhalo, that which is asaram, which is having no substance? So for the materialistic demeanor, existential education, or education dealing with existential issues such as who am I, what is the purpose of life, how do I obtain that purpose, generally, the answers for these types of questions are metaphysical. They're not practical. And for the materialistic demeanor, only knowledge which is practically useful is of great importance, generally. And even for devotees, we enter into devotional service looking for solutions to the existential issues of life, such as looking for answers to questions about the self, about the world, about the source of both. We start our spiritual investigation, but many times that spiritual investigation may become eclipsed by practical issues such as health of the body, which is not unimportant, how to pay bills, you know, how to survive in this world. In the case of Prahlada Maharaj, understanding friends and enemies, that's what Hiranyakashipu thought was practical. So we may even start devotional service with the understanding that I need answers to the existential issues of life. But practical life tends to eclipse that search. And therefore, for all pragmatic purposes, knowledge of Krishna consciousness becomes asaram. It becomes not having much substance because they don't seem to directly give solutions to the practical issues of our life, how to pay the bills. Now, you don't go to the spiritual master, how to pay the bills, and he starts speaking about Krishna consciousness. You feel disturbed. Or sometimes when you have practical issues like some problem at the workspace or problems with other devotees where you're feeling emotional turmoil and so on, and you go to the spiritual master and he starts speaking about jiva tattva, you know, you're not this body, you're not this mind, and you feel like, what is this? This is not practical, this is not reasonable. So even for devotees, sometimes we may enter into that space, especially when we're, you know, emotionally troubled or something, where knowledge of Krishna consciousness seems asaram, not having much substance. How am I going to solve my issues of life just by sitting and chanting and talking about Krishna? That doesn't seem practical. Just like Parikshit Maharaj, he's going to die. That's an existential issue. How to deal with death. Not only death in terms of the final annihilation of the body, but the different periods of our life, which is something like a death. You know, going from one phase of life to another phase of life. It's certainly like a death to a particular phase of life. And therefore, transitions are never very easy. They're very difficult. And one may also find themselves toiling with those transitions, you know, trying to deal with them in a very practical way, and finding oneself more entangled in material nature. So how did Parikshit Maharaj solve this particular existential question of life? He went to the bank of the Ganga and sat down and heard the Bhagavatam for 7 days. That was his solution to the problem. So even for practicing devotees, we sometimes get in this space where spiritual knowledge may appear to be asaram. And certainly for the materialistic demeanor, it's certainly useless. I've given many times the example of being at DePaul University, and we were sitting outside doing kirtan, and there was some political protesting going on in like the student union. So they invited us into the student union. So I said, no, it's okay. We'll just be here chanting. So this particular student became a little frustrated and said, what are you doing to help the political situation? I said, can't you see? We're chanting Hare Krishna. And he was probably disgusted, you know, just kind of like rolled his eyes. This is useless. So that is the nature of the materialistic demeanor. They see Krishna consciousness, which is the answer to our real problems in life, which are existential problems, actually, as useless. Such is the case. Any questions? This is the Prabhupada. I'm going to move on, but this is what's described here. Prabhupada gave a short purport here. Any questions about this point? Anything anyone wants to ask? No? Okay, where is everyone else? Marky and Michael. I think Himanshu went with his mother somewhere. And anyway, Justin and Manoj went too. Okay. All right, next verse. Santi ya sadavo loke durmaitrash chatma veshinaha te sham udhet yagham kale roga patakinam iva. Translation. In due course of time, various types of diseases are manifest in those who are sinful. Similarly, in this world, there are many deceptive friends in false garbs, but eventually, because of their false behavior, their actual enmity becomes manifest. So Hiranyakashipu is telling Shanda that persons who are asadavo, dishonest persons, durmaitraha, cheating friends, chadma veshinaha, wearing the vesh, vesha means like a dress. They're wearing the dress of, wearing false garb. So they're wearing a dress of friendship. But in their heart, they are cheating friends. They have enmity toward you. Sometimes you may have had that experience in life, at least you view it that way, where someone is pretending to be a friend, essentially, but wearing the false garb of a friend in order to hurt you more deeply. So then Hiranyakashipu is saying here, just like diseases in due course of time arise in the body of sinful persons, so similarly in due course of time their enmity comes out. So he's chastising Shanda, saying that you've now shown enmity towards me by teaching Prahlad Maharaj about devotional service. You've manifested your practical hatred for me. You're in this dress of a friend, but now you've proven that you're indeed my enemy. How is that? Because you've taught my son devotional service. Demonic mentality. It's heavy. Purport by Srila Prabhupada Ki Jai. Being anxious about the education of his boy Prahlad, Hiranyakashipu was very much dissatisfied. When Prahlad began teaching about devotional service, Hiranyakashipu immediately regarded the teachers as his enemies in the garb of friends. In this verse, the words roga patakinam iva refer to disease, which is the most sinful and miserable of the conditions of material life, jama mritu jara vyadi. Disease is the symptom of the body of a sinful person. The Smriti Shastra say, Brahmaha kshaya rogi syat surapa shavadantaka swarna haritu kunaki durstarma guru talpagaha. Murderers of brahmanas are later afflicted by tuberculosis. Drunkards become toothless. Those who have stolen gold are afflicted by diseased nails. And sinful men who have sexual connections with the wife of a superior are afflicted by leprosy and similar skin diseases. Hare Krishna. Any questions about this? I've already described what Hiranyakashipu was saying here. Yeah. Is it on? The green light should turn on if it's... is on, so something's running there. All right, you can go.
Devotees, devotees are always in the mood of goodness or pure goodness. And
that's very kind of you. Okay.
And why sometimes devotees also suffer with diseases, like exalted devotees. I have been quoted a question like, Madhvacharya or great acharyas are pure souls. Then why does a pure soul suffer with the diseases? Here it is little bit contradictory, but just want to understand that, Prabhu.
It appears that way. I need a 10th canto. Who's got a computer? Can you pull up 10th canto, chapter 87? There are many answers to this question. Essentially, the suffering or enjoyment of a devotee is given by the Supreme Lord Krishna. Why would the Supreme Lord give suffering? Yeah, hold on. There's a very beautiful verse in the 10th canto, chapter 87, which is discussed by all of our acharyas in relationship to this particular question. One famous verse is Tate anukampam sukshamikshamano bunjana evatmakritam vipakam hirvag vapubir vidadan namaste jiveta yo muktipade siddhaya bhak. You know this verse? You know this verse? This famous verse. The verse describes that the devotee who is anukampam sukshamikshamano, he is very eagerly awaiting for the anukampam, the mercy of the Lord. In the meantime, bunjana evatma kritam vipakam, he is tolerating the reactions to his own sinful misdeeds. Bunjana means like to enjoy. So the sense of the word is that you have to eat what you cook. You know, just like when I was in Vrindavan, I was trying to cook for the more or less the first time by myself. And the first time I made khichdi, it was rough. But I had to eat it. I guess I could have fed it to the monkeys also. But the sense of this word, bunjana, means you have to eat what you cook. So you perform certain activities in one lifetime, and one has to suffer the reactions of those activities. So this is the case for conditioned souls, certainly. That is clear. So Sri Vishwanath Chakravarti Thakur in this verse brings up the point. But Krishna mentioned that if anyone surrenders to him, then he will relieve them from all sinful reactions, isn't it? Sri Vishwanath brings up this point, and he says, indeed, this is true. Therefore, the suffering of the devotee is not due to karma, but rather due to the Supreme Lord who is giving it. So there are several reasons why the Supreme Lord may do that to his devotee. One reason is to set up a standard of pure devotion, like in the case of Prahlad Maharaj. We'll hear this in chapter 10 of this canto. To set up the example of the position of pure devotion and what is the standard that one has to come to. Sometimes often we may become discouraged or we have some particular problem, and then Prahlad Maharaj will be given as an example. And we say, well, that's Prahlad Maharaj and I'm me. But actually the highest standard is given so that one can understand what is the fitness that they have to do to come to that level of consciousness. Another reason that the Lord may give, these are all points mentioned by Sri Vishwanath in several purports I'm thinking about, is to augment the devotee's humility and also augment the devotee's longing for absolute beatitude. In other words, by receiving suffering of the body, the devotee's longing for the absolute truth, spiritual swarup to serve the Supreme Lord will be augmented by such suffering. Or even enjoyment. But you're asking in terms of the suffering. There's one other reason. Oh, yes. And the other reason Sri Vishwanath gives, this is a third reason, or fourth one, which I'm mentioning, he gives by which a devotee may suffer, is to protect the conceptions of the karmis and ganis. In other words, if they see that by devotional service, one does not grow old, one does not get disease, and so on, then they'll lose all faith in karma and gan. And one thinks that, well, that sounds good, doesn't it? Yeah, they should lose faith in karma again. The thing is that without bhakta sangha, they don't gain faith in bhakti either. The movement in devotional service is the gracious grant of bhaktas of the Lord. Adhau shraddha. The word adhau means in the beginning. So in the beginning, there is sadhu sangha. And thereafter that, there is shraddha. So normally we think of adhau shraddha as one stage. We say adhau shraddha tata sadhu sangha tata bhajanakri like this. But actually the word adhau is itself a stage also. Adhau, in the beginning. In the beginning what? In the beginning there is bhakta sangha. And from that Bhakta Sangha, Shraddha. And with Shraddha, movement in bhakti is able to take place. So if they lose faith in the scriptures discussing karma and gyan, and also they're devoid of Bhakta Sangha because of lack of Shraddha, then they'll not do bhakti, they'll not do karma again also, and then they will become completely degraded. So another reason Sri Vishnu outlines, and you can see these points I'm giving in second canto, chapter 3, verse 17, Sri Vishnu Chakravarti Thakura's commentary there, is to protect the, so this third one is to protect the opinions of the karmis and gyanis, so that they don't lose faith in karma and gyan, which would be inauspicious for humanity. Anyway, just to underscore the point that I'm making here. This is from the 10th canto, chapter 87, verse number 40, describing a devotee. When a person realizes you, he no longer cares about his good and bad fortune arising from past pious and sinful acts, since it is you alone who control this good and bad fortune. Such a realized devotee also disregards what ordinary living beings say about him. This is due to your extremely sinful reactions that you like this. Every day he fills his ears with your glories. In other words, that's what he's doing. Instead of concerning himself with what's happening, he's just filling his ears with the glories of the Lord, knowing in his heart that whatever good and bad fortune is coming to him is coming from the Supreme Lord himself. These are several answers to that question. Yeah.
Jai Hare Krishna. Oh. So in this series of verses, it appears that Harani Kashipu is doing something that we have a tendency to do all the time, is to jump to conclusions. He accused Shukracharya of teaching Prahlad, okay, Maharaj, and in our case, that could cause a lot of offenses. So how do we basically not jump to conclusions in our practical lives of, you know, because that's the tendency of the mind, just to find faults with others, then we jump to conclusions.
So if you're in the mode of passion, you will do it. If you're in the mode of ignorance, you will do it. The mode of goodness means contemplation. So it means the mind will jump, but you will think before saying anything. So if one lives a life of passionate ignorance, then expect to jump to conclusions and then spew it and commit offenses and all that. By devotional service, if one follows the sadhana bhakti format given by Srila Prabhupada, our acharyas, then you will come through the mode of goodness, through that. And that way you should become more thoughtful individual. Otherwise, if you're in passionate ignorance, then that is your life. What to do? It's not like you can just get out of it. It's nothing like, I should not jump to conclusions. Are you impassioned? Yeah, you will jump to conclusions. It's nothing like, I will not do. You will do. So it's a question of elevating consciousness. You know, no amount of proscriptive instructions like you should or should not do will in and of itself be useful. One has to elevate himself through the material nature, and that's most easily done by surrender to Krishna. Mam eva ye prapatyante mayami tam tarantite. Like this. Any other questions? Terrence, you saw me? No? Okay. Anything else? No, no. Oh, okay. Otherwise, I'm going to move on. We're going to do a marathon.
I was just focus. A little confused. I lost the train of thought from where Hiranyakashipu was mad about the teachers to like this point of like suffering or something like that.
What point of suffering?
Like devotees suffering.
Well, in the verse, Hiranyakashipu is saying that false friends, someone is wearing the dress of friendship, but in due course of time, their real position comes out, especially if they're inimical. So in the same way, just like when a person is sinful in his previous life, in due course of time, in this life, he develops diseases in the body. So he's criticizing Shanda of being inwardly inimical, but pretending to be a friend in order to hurt him at the right time, and then it's coming out. So then, just because that example was given about the sinful person, so then the question came up. Why is it that it is seen that devotees also suffer what appears to be sinful reactions like that? Any other questions? Next verse. Sri Guru Putra Uvacha. So this is Chandra responding. He's pretty afraid. Na mat pranitam na pada pranitam suto vadatyesha tavindra shatro Naisargiki yang materasinar jan yacha man yum kad kadadhas mamana. Translation: the son of Shukracharya Hiranyakashipu's spiritual master said, "O enemy of King Indra." So this is important. O enemy of King Indra, not enemy of Brahmanas. That's the import of that statement according to Sri Vishwanath. O king, whatever your son Prahlad has said was not taught to him by me or anyone else. His spontaneous devotional service is naturally developed in him. Naisargiki, iyam, mati. So this mati, this sort of intelligence, is naisargiki. It's spontaneously coming out. We don't know where it's coming from. Therefore, please give up your anger and do not unnecessarily accuse us. It is not good to insult a brahmana in this way. So, it's his fault. Don't insult us. Next verse. No purport to this verse. Sri Narada Uvacha. Guru naivham pratiprokto bhuya ahasura sutam nachet guru mukhiyam te kuto badrasati mati. This is nice. This is a good question. Hiranyakashipu was about to ask Prahlad Maharaj a really good question. He's not going to say it very nicely, but it's a really good question. Sri Narada Muni continued, when Hiranyakashipu received this reply from the teacher, he again addressed his son Prahlad. Hiranyakashipu said, "You rascal, most fallen of our family," or the actual Sanskrit, "Abhadra Sati Mati." Oh, inauspicious child. It's translated that by Sri Vishwanath. That's heavy to hear from your father, huh? Just 2 seconds ago, he was sniffing your head and crying as the description was given. Now he's throwing his son. I think, yeah, this is the picture here. It's a good one. Oh, inauspicious child. Just like when we were children. I don't know if you remember this, but the cooties. I don't know if you remember. Do any of you remember that? Playing the cooties. So like something like, almost as if some stool is falling on him. Oh, inauspicious child, Abhadra Sati Mati. So he's asking the question here. If you have not received this education from your teachers, where have you gotten it? Very good question. How have you become Krishna conscious? Very good question. In fact, Vyasadeva, he didn't ask this question, but it was explained by Narada Muni how he became Krishna conscious. So to hear how devotees become Krishna conscious is enlightening. Or let's say, only when it serves an enlightening function is it proper to speak about yourself, generally, when it's serving some function of enlightenment. So otherwise devotees don't speak about themselves. But if it serves some enlightening function, they will speak about themselves. So you see Narada Muni in the first canto speaking about himself quite elaborately. Why? Because it demonstrates the process of Krishna consciousness. So he does so. So the question here, how did you become Krishna conscious, is a very beautiful question. He just didn't express it very politely. You know, sometimes we do that also. We have good questions, but it comes off a little bit arrogant or whatever. Purport by Srila Prabhupada Ki Jai. Srila Vishwanath Chakravarti Thakur explains that devotional service is actually Bhadra Sati, which means auspicious, not Abhadra Sati, inauspicious. In other words, knowledge of devotional service can be neither inauspicious nor contrary to etiquette. To learn devotional service is the duty of everyone. It's the duty of humanity to learn devotional service. Savai Pum Samparo Dharmo Yato Bhaktir Dadokshajay. The sages inquired, what is the duty of humanity? So what was the answer they were given? Paradharma, the supreme dharma for all of humanity, is that dharma that leads to the development of bhakti to adokshaja. Yato bhaktir adokshaja. Yato bhaktir means prema. So that dharma that leads to prema for adokshaja. And then that prema is described, ahaituki, without material cause. In other words, not available in the material world. Apratiyata, it is not interrupted because of the blissful nature of it. One cannot think to live without bhakti. This is the nature of prema bhakti. Yayatma supersidati. Only by this prema There will be Atma supersedati. There will be satisfaction of the Atma. So that supreme dharma which leads to this prema bhakti, that is the supreme dharma for all of humanity, the supreme education. So Prabhupada says it, to learn devotional service is the duty of everyone. And to not do so is a transgression, even, of scriptures, at least as taught by Srimad Bhagavatam. Last sentence of Prabhupada's purport. Therefore, the spontaneous education of Prahlad Maharaj is supported as auspicious and perfect. Any questions about this? Yeah. It's 7:58. I may do one more verse. These next three verses are very famous. Srila Prabhupada even chants them as a bhajan, which we play sometimes on the altar. The next three verses, worth learning. They're very famous. Yeah.
Hare Krishna. So in this purport, it mentions that devotional service is not contrary to etiquette. And so
devotional service is not contrary to etiquette. Okay.
So this reminds me of what Bhaktivinoda Thakur says in Amarjivan. I resist all pious deeds, but I'm very enthusiastic to perform wicked acts. So in this verse, or throughout the Bhagavatam, this canto, Hiranyakashipu was considering Prahlad's glorification of God and devotees as wicked, basically. So in our practical lives, I didn't exactly have time to formulate the question properly, but my direction I'm going with this is that, like in the second stanza of Lord Chaitanya's verse, he says, there are no hard and fast rule for chanting names, and similarly, better than worship of Vishnu is the Vaishnava. So in that sense, in any environment, to glorify any devotee or that can never be considered contrary to etiquette, because the tendency is that we're very resisting to honor someone, but we're under the modes, we're very enthusiastic to dishonor someone or gossip or slander characters in that sense. So in that sense, can you elaborate on that point a little bit, if you like?
Okay, Krishna is all-pervading. Krishna exists with his eternal shaktis. And so as Krishna is all-pervading, so also his spiritual shaktis are also all-pervading. And therefore, the Supreme Lord is to be served in all time and space, because he's beyond time and space, or he pervades all time and space. And therefore, Krishna, along with his internal potencies, are to be glorified and served in all time and space. Yeah, that's fine. Sometimes there is context. For example, like a Bhagavatam class. When Bhagavatam class is going on, then one should stick to Bhagavatam class. It shouldn't become just a space for just glorifying one another, for example, unless it serves some relationship to what's being discussed in the Bhagavatam particularly. That's what we come to the Bhagavatam class for. Indeed, I heard one Srila Prabhupada disciple telling us in Vrindavan during the 40th anniversary. Some may disagree with this, but I personally appreciate this point. He said even when devotees give class and they simply just tell Prabhupada stories, he said that's not good standard. And he said Prabhupada, when Prabhupada was around and we were giving classes with Prabhupada there, he wanted us to quote the scripture and stick to what Srimad Bhagavatam was talking about. And no, not just instead of quoting, but just telling Prabhupada stories without it having any exact bearing on what's being discussed in context of the Bhagavatam for that day. You know, just, you know, and many devotees do this, I'm sorry to say, but, you know, it's as if whatever's being discussed in the purport is non-essential. You just kind of like read it, and then you just, you know, could just close it up and put it away, and then start speaking stories and talking about this and that, and it does not pertain to what's being discussed in the Bhagavatam that day. So this Srila Prabhupada disciple, Gurudas, he was telling us like this, and I personally appreciated that, that his realization on that point. So there's in some places there is an etiquette. Even within devotional service, there's etiquettes to be followed as such. So glorifying devotees, which is a particular example you've given, is certainly auspicious in any time and space. But within the Bhagavatam class, it should serve its enlightening function also. And otherwise, also doesn't set up a good culture, because devotees who are less mature will start just thinking that glorifying each other is what it means to give a Bhagavatam discussion. And that's not correct either. I remember being in Chaupati And one of my god brothers, he was very new, he was giving class on the Vyasa-san. He read the purport and then spoke some story from Mahabharata, you know, and telling jokes and all that. So I was furious about the class. So I asked the devotee who was arranging for the class, his name was Gokulananda also, but he's Indian body, god brother. I said, do you give any feedback for the classes, you know? And he said, no, we don't give any feedback. Like, as long as they're speaking, you know, sense. I'm like, but did you hear the class? He didn't speak anything Prabhupada was discussing in the purport. How is that proper? He just started telling stories and this and that. So then what was the use in reading the purport then? You could have just sat down, Sanjay Vadamanava, and started talking. And that way we, at least we would know that we weren't hearing the Bhagavad Gita or Bhagavatam, and that you were just mouthing off something on the Vyasa-san. So there should be some, there is etiquette there also. You know, when we come to the Bhagavatam class, this is going to sound a little revolutionary, but hearing Bhagavatam means you hear the Bhagavatam. Sounds a little revolutionary, right? Hearing Bhagavatam means literally you're hearing the Bhagavatam, you're hearing devotees quoting the Bhagavatam. Essentially, hearing Bhagavatam means you're hearing more and more verses taken from Bhagavatam and glorified in context to a particular point. So hearing the Bhagavatam means hearing the Bhagavatam. Not just hearing stories and hearing anecdotes. You may ornament your discussion with a little bit of that for clarifying certain points or bringing out certain points. But we also see Srila Prabhupada never got so much into that either. When you look at the classes, it didn't like he'd go on and on telling stories, for example. He would do so only when it serves some, generally, not always, but generally when it serves some philosophical purpose. He wants to establish some point, he would tell a quote. And that too, he would leave out a lot of details. It wasn't like he would go into all the you know, and then he would just tell a story as it related to that particular philosophical point he was making. Otherwise, people get lost also. When the things are real long and elaborate, then they start to lose focus on the essence of what you're trying to say in the discussion. Many times, I've seen that, where I'll ask a devotee after the class, so what was the class about? And they said, I really like that story. That's nice. My question was, what was the class about? Well, that story was really good. It was really funny. And then, so they're missing many times like that. So then that should be taken into consideration as well. Like that. So it should have some enlightenment function. Any other questions or comments, feedback? Yeah, Terrence, Prabhu, and Mother. Or here, you can bring in Mother Lakshmi Moni and then Terrence. I didn't see her. Maybe I have to stop here.
Krishna, Hari Baba. Just a point to make that Srila Prabhupada kind of created the purport of the Bhagavatam by his own personal ecstasy in many cases, not always, but in many cases. For instance, in some purports of the Bhagavatam, he describes all the different individuals, who is Bhishma, who is. That was specifically for us. I mean, that's not in Vishwanath Chakravarti Thakur's purports, because everybody that read those knew who those people were. And also in Prabhupada's lectures on the Bhagavatam, he tended to apply the Bhagavatam to what was going on in our need. Over and over again, you'll see the same topics, even though the Bhagavatam verses are Bhagavatam verses, whatever they are. And then he'll apply it, but he'll also speak again and again. Very often he'll speak about animal slaughter and how it's very low class and, you know, they say their religion. And he had a few different things that he would address on a regular basis. Very often he would tell stories, and he would tell them in a very, very animated way. And I agree with you that when someone says, I remember the story, if they don't remember what the story was about, I mean, the connection, the philosophical connection, then it's pretty much useless. But very often stories can illustrate a point, and our acharyas use them. Narada Muni uses them, right? The whole allegory of Paranjana is a story. But it applies to the topic, and because it's a story, you remember it. Right. It sticks in your brain. So very often stories are helpful, and Prabhupada used them, and he used them, if you ever saw, if you look at Srila Prabhupada give classes, sometimes we see Prabhupada giving classes, but the classes that are taped aren't the same class that he's really giving. You see these pictures and they're kind of unrelated. But very time, often Prabhupada would tell stories and he'd be very animated, you know, his eyes would get big and he'd almost act them out. And but he, you know, of course the purport had something to do with the message that he wanted to give us. So the message is the medium carries the message, and we should use the medium that works. And Prabhupada wanted us to speak the Bhagavatam, but he also wanted us to speak each verse and give as much information as we could, even if the purport were small. He wanted us to evolve it in our thought process and by discussion so that it would enliven us in Krishna consciousness. So sometimes he would tack on, you know, many, many different topics to a verse that appeared to be unrelated, but in his mind were important for us to learn.
Yeah. So, yeah, that's the same point that we're describing. The storytelling and other anecdotes and so on, they should serve its enlightenment function in terms of what's being, ideally in terms of what's being discussed in the Bhagavatam. And of course, also Prabhupada was guru, so he has a lot more liberty than maybe some of us have in terms of addressing people who may not have faith in us. So therefore, in Bhagavatam, it's safe to just stick to the context in which we're discussing, like this. Yeah.
Hare Krishna. This question is more or less a two-part question in relationship to what you were saying earlier in class, how someone has to develop faith in bhakta before they can move forward in devotional service.
Well, just to clarify, in the beginning, there's the chance association of devotees. Yeah. And from that association, faith evolves like that.
Okay. And my question is kind of, it's connected with what Lakshmi Moni was saying. When you speak about verses from the Bhagavatam, how you speak about them in relationship to the class or whatever the topic was on. And one thing I was going to ask you is, you were saying the other evening how, and as far as like association or relationship in the beginning, it could be based off of who inspires you. It's not so much how elevated they are, but where you get that inspiration from in your association. So, you know, let's say someone may not give Bhagavatam class, or they may not be able to quote so many verses in Sanskrit, but you feel more of a relationship with that devotee, not based off of anything external, but more it's a personal relationship. And let's say someone maybe may have more intelligence, so they may have more of a proclivity for studying, and you know, they know verse, but you don't necessarily feel that same connection. So my question in relationship to that point you were making earlier is which is more conducive for like the right attitude to have as far as association and also relating the message in Bhagavatam to how we can apply it to like just our everyday lives, if that makes sense.
Okay, there was a lot there. Just a clarification on what I was speaking earlier, means upstairs in the room. We were mentioning that Srila Rupa Goswami discusses in the Nectar of Devotion, Bhakti Rasamrita Sindhu, who has adhikar for bhakti. That was the context of the discussion. So adhikar for bhakti means you should have faith, shraddha. And that faith comes from the chance meeting with devotees. But after gaining faith, one's faith has to be informed by knowledge. So then Rupa Goswami speaks of different persons classified as beginner, intermediate, and advanced according to their knowledge. And when he gives a definition, he gives that adhikar according to their knowledge primarily. And on the strength of such devotional knowledge, it's not just knowing stuff, but devotional knowledge, then their faith is deepened accordingly. So he describes the neophyte's faith as komala shraddha. He describes the Mahadhamma's faith as dridha, which means like determined faith. And he describes the Uttama Adhikari's faith as prodha, which means deep, very deep faith. How did it become deep? Because if it is studying the shastra, sarvata, dridha nishchaya, by studying all the shastras in its entirety and gaining sambandha abhideya, prayojangan, knowledge of the conceptions, knowledge of the methodology, knowledge of the goal. That's how his faith became deep. So the adhikar for bhakti is faith, and then that faith has to be informed by proper knowledge in order for it to become deep. So that was the context. Those were the statements discussed from Bhakti Rasamrita Sindhu specifically. So the question was, how do we recognize guru upstairs? Because this is the element you're bringing up. And I gave as a practical criteria, one has to see how one's faith is being uplifted. And so it can't just be, you know, as you were mentioning, this devotee may be more intelligent, but I resonate more with this devotee. That's totally fine. Wherever one's faith is feeling uplifted, but one's faith has to also be informed by knowledge. Krishna mentioned in the Bhagavad Gita, Bahavo Gana Tapasa Putama Bhavamagata, that those who develop love for me, Bahavo Gana Tapasa, they've gone through the austerity of knowledge, which means the austerity of hearing / study of the Shruti and Smriti, the scriptures describing bhakti. And in this way, after giving up attachment, fear, and anger, they develop love for me also. So that austerity, so one has to see how one's faith is being uplifted, but we have to be aware that sometimes what may be inspiring for us may be because someone has a similar mode of nature as we do. So because I'm in ignorance, someone in ignorance inspires me. Because I'm in passion, someone in passion inspires me. Because I'm in goodness, someone in goodness inspires me. So that inspiration can't be the only criteria that we're judging our movement and bhakti from. That can't be the only criteria. The other criteria is they have to be able to enlighten us. And that doesn't mean that they're able to quote thousands of shlokas necessarily. But they know the Bhagavatam. Rather, they can quote so many verses. That just may be a karmic thing, where you have a really sharp memory, a sharp intellect, and so on. But they know the message of the Bhagavatam, and they can express it according to the teachings of our acharyas. Whether or not they're able to always do so by quoting verses is not exactly necessary as such, but they know it. Otherwise, that inspiration will never allow your faith to become deep alone. The faith becomes deep on account of hearing. Shravanam is the first process for that reason. By hearing / study of the teachings of Siddhanta. So that has to also be a criterion in one's consideration. Not only is my faith inspired, but my faith is also informed. Otherwise, it becomes a blind faith. There are many persons who have faith. That's not too difficult. But when there's not proper knowledge, that faith is necessarily blind. So we want not a blind faith, but we want a seeing faith. You know, a faith that is allowed to see by dint of transcendental knowledge. Sambandha Abhideya Prayojan, again, like this. Yeah.
I guess what you're saying, just for clarification, yeah, is faith has to be established through some form of knowledge. And that once one gains a certain level of faith, that they will endeavor more to acquire the knowledge to implement the faith.
Yeah, just a little slight edit. The second part is good. The first part is that one gets faith somehow or other. You associate with devotees and somehow or other faith is born in you by serving them, mahasevaya vipra, punya tutani shevanat, by hearing their kirtan, by having to hear a little discussion that's going on between devotees. Somehow or other you gain faith in the sangha of devotees. But then that faith is the initial impetus. It's like getting some initial capital to a business. If you want to be an entrepreneur, and some initial capital is given to you to start your business. But that initial capital in and of itself does not allow for a successful business. You need more investors. Like that. So similarly, that faith is like the initial capital given by the association of sadhus. But thereafter, you need more investors. And those more investors means association of devotees who will speak to you transcendental knowledge so that you can expand that capital, which means in this context, expanding one's faith and making it deep. So your second statement is correct. So somehow or other, someone gets faith. But now, and to grow the faith, you need transcendental knowledge. So sometimes devotees very much mistakenly make this point in their classes, I've heard it many times, where it's not about knowledge, it's about bhakti. This sort of statement needs to be clarified. What do you mean by knowledge in this context? Because the knowledge and relationship to Krishna is bhakti. Therefore, Rupa Goswami says, Jnana Karmadi Anavritam. Jnana Karma Adi Anavritam. Anavritam means eclipse. Pure devotion is not eclipsed by jnana, by karma, by yoga, vairagya, tapasya, Adi means etc. Anavritam. So in this verse, Rupa Goswami said, it's not eclipsed by knowledge. In the first line of the verse, it says, Anyabilashita Shunyam. That pure devotion is devoid of desiredness, mundane desires for bhukti, mukti, enjoyment and liberation. But for the second line, he uses the word anavritam. The first line, he says shunyam, which means zero. And the second line, he says anavritam, not covered. So our acharyas point out that there's a significance of the two adjectives that he's using to modify the phrase. He uses that for material desires, those have to be zero. But for knowledge, it should not be covered by the wrong type of knowledge, the wrong type of karma activity, the wrong type of tapasya, vairagya, etc. So what does that mean? That there's a right type of gyan, there's a right type of karma, there's a proper type of tapasya, it means austerity and renunciation in relationship to devotion. So sometimes devotees make this false dichotomy between bhakti and gyan. Which could be true when you're talking about impersonal knowledge. But when you're talking about the knowledge that's inherent to devotion, that knowledge is bhakti as well. So that knowledge is absolutely required for gaining more and more depth in Krishna consciousness. So one can't just dismiss that. You know, dismiss the need for gaining such bhakti gyan. Krishna, in fact, refers to bhakti as jnana in the beginning of chapter 2. Idam tu te guhyatamam pravakshami anasuyave jnana vijnana saritam moksha she ashubat. What is that? Gantwa moksha she ashubat. He refers to bhakti specifically as jnana in the beginning of chapter 9 of Bhagavad Gita. So, faith is required. That faith comes by the chance association with devotees. And that faith is augmented by hearing primarily from sadhus. And what does that hearing transmit to you? Devotional knowledge. Therefore, Bhagavad Gita. Bhagavad Gita means what? The song of God. Krishna, and how the song, he's speaking to Arjuna, devotional knowledge. And that's how Arjuna's doubts are being crushed. That is how his faith is being augmented, expressed as complete surrender to Krishna. The external expression of faith is surrender, like this. So that dichotomy should not be made when discussing devotional knowledge. One has to gain devotional knowledge, otherwise it's just sentimentalism. And so Mahaprabhu, that's why Mahaprabhu was getting criticized by the Mayavadis. You're just a sentimentalist, bhavuka. Of course, bhavuka means one who has bhav, so that's a compliment, really. You're full of emotion. It's really a compliment, but they took it in a negative way. You're just an emotionalist, a sentimentalist. And you're a sannyasi, you should be studying Vedanta like us. That's impersonal gyan, non-devotional knowledge. So Mahaprabhu said, my spiritual master told me I'm not qualified to just chant Hare Krishna. So that's what I'm doing, I'm chanting Hare Krishna. But after that, after he was able to capture the hearts of the Mayavadis, he went on to explain Vedanta Sutra, giving a devotional import to it. So he had knowledge. It wasn't that he was without knowledge. He had the knowledge. And then he began to describe that. Sometimes the example may be given of the South Indian Brahmin, where he didn't have knowledge. He simply got an instruction from his guru to read Bhagavad Gita. But he was illiterate. And I think he was reading the Bhagavad Gita upside down, you know, and turn around like this. And everyone was laughing at him, other Brahmins. This illiterate fellow, what is he doing? He doesn't know what he's doing. But when Mahaprabhu saw him, he always had tears in his eyes. And so Mahaprabhu asked him, you know, why are you crying? Clearly, you don't know how to read Bhagavad Gita such, but you're always crying. So he says, when I see that Krishna is the chariot driver of Arjuna, that even though he's the Supreme Lord, he agrees to become the chariot driver of Arjuna, my heart is overwhelmed with emotion, and I begin to cry just thinking about that. Has that ever happened to you? You know, he didn't even have a picture to look at. It was just like in his mind, and he was overwhelmed with devotion. We have a picture to look at, and we don't feel anything. You see it like Jaya Bhagavad Gita. You know, you just open it and begin the class. You know, it doesn't even register in your mind that the picture is of any significance as such. Immediately, tears would come from his eyes. So then, this example is given to show that knowledge is not important oftentimes. But that is not a very clear example, because clearly this person was probably on the platform above. If by just thinking of that, tears are coming to the eyes, that doesn't mean a devotional sadhaka. That means a sadhya bhakta, one who's on the platform of devotional attainment. So when describing sadhakas, Rupa Goswami is given an elaborate literature. His magnum opus is the Bhakti Rasamrita Sindhu. And in that literature, he's given the details of the science of how to progress. So just throwing out examples like Jatabharata didn't have a guru. Sometimes I've heard devotees do this sometimes. Jatabharata didn't have a guru, so that means you don't need a guru. You know, you have all full of anarthas, you don't need a guru to get out of that. And because Jatabharata didn't have a guru, they'll quote that example. Or they'll say, even Dhruva Maharaj, ... That does not present anything scientifically. Luckily, we don't have to figure out the science because Rupa Goswami has already presented it in literatures like Bhakti Rasamrita Sindhu. So if we want to understand how to progress as sadhaka scientifically, then we should hear those literatures from devotees, the books that are dealing with the science. Otherwise, we become sentimentalists, just ad hoc quoting our own examples. In the Bhagavatam, this. We see this in the Bhagavatam. We see that in the Bhagavatam. We see that from Prabhupada's life. Many times, Prabhupada's example is given also without any context. No one knows what the person is actually talking about. They have some impression of something, and they're just presenting some Prabhupada quote that matches their particular impression of that something, not sharing the context of a particular statement and so on. That is not scientific presentation. The scientific presentation of Krishna consciousness is given in literature such as BRS, Nectar Devotion, Bhakti Sandarbha. Why do our acharyas go through the trouble to write all these literatures? Madhura Kandambini, Rag Bhartma Chandrika, Upadeshamrita. These are all literatures dealing with the actual science of devotional service and how it progresses. So devotees who want to present bhakti scientifically, as Prabhupada has asked us to do in so many of his purports, then you have to hear those books and learn those books, either by studying, and if our intellect is too dull to study, which is quite possible, then you can learn by hearing. It is not that anyone is ousted from the process. You can learn as much as a scholar simply by hearing from a devotee who knows the science. And you can gain all the same knowledge as anyone else simply by the process of hearing. It's quite possible. It's not impossible. You have to hear from devotees who... The word was used even by Srila Prabhupada a few purports ago, and the enlightened devotee. The enlightened devotee. Why is Prabhupada always mentioned like that? Hear from the self-realized devotee. The enlightened devotee. So it is underscored in Prabhupada's teachings that hearing from advanced devotees is required. That is required. That is a requirement of the science. So that can't just be eschewed or dismissed on the strength of I'm inspired in that way. That's okay. I'm not challenging that, but for those who are actually wanting to make progress in the goal of life, they're going to be considering all these sorts of points. My inspiration can't be the only criteria for my moving ahead in bhakti. That is certainly an important criteria. You need to be inspired. Maya is very discouraging on a daily basis. So one needs to be encouraged, certainly, or inspired. But that's not the only criteria. The criteria is given in books, scientific literature such as BRS, Bhakti Sandarbha, Nectar of Instruction, even Sharanagati, Bhajana Rahasya, etc. So many literatures describing the science. Bhavo Gana Tapasa. One should take that austerity to hear these things and learn. Bhakti Gan, that is required. Like this. Any final points? Jai Baladev Prabhu.
Thank you for your class. I guess you don't have to keep this up because I don't want to go
there's
over the time.
There's only 3 minutes. So, yeah.
So you were mentioning illiterate Brahmanist story. And from our perspective, maybe you could speak a little bit about the mercy point, basically. So from our perspective, the Brahmin, of course, was illiterate, and he attained the mercy of the Lord. And that's kind of like not the main thing. That's kind of like an exception we usually see. But in can you elaborate on a point that, in one sense, that you could also say we're all illiterate in the sense that in chapter 15 of the Gita, Krishna says that from me comes knowledge, remembrance and forgiveness. And if we're suffering from cancer, where's our knowledge? Or we're not thinking about knowledge. Or basically everything in our life is dependent on mercy, whatever knowledge, memory. So in that sense, and even emotions, like that verse says, Kali Kaleta Dharma Krishnanam Sankirtan Krishna Shakti Vina Nahi Tata Pravartana, unless one is empowered by Krishna, one cannot chant the holy names. So in one sense, it seems like we're all, you know, illiterate. We have no knowledge. So can you speak more about the, because we see in the Bhakti Siddhanta's pastime, he was disgusted with his disciples who, you know, are bickering over petty stuff. So how do we stay in Krishna consciousness essentially? Because it seems like it's Kali Yuga, it's not getting better, you know. We get into these little, you know, in one sense, disagreements are good because that increases our, you know, that makes us inspired to understand more of the tapas and truths and stuff. But how do we, I don't know, I guess a question, how do we basically, can you speak about the mercy point essentially? That seems to be the crown jewel of anything we have in our Krishna consciousness.
Oh, well, yeah, mercy is such a generic term. Devotees use it in so many different contexts. Faith is mercy. The path of sadhana is mercy. The scientific literatures of our acharyas is mercy to us so that we can scientifically apply Krishna consciousness and scientifically get the goal of life. But the final goal of life is also mercy. You know, you can advance through sadhana. And that advancement in sadhana is mercy of sadhus and mercy of the literatures that they write. But the final attainment is also mercy. So mercy refers to all of this. The whole thing is mercy. But then you can see there's like installments of mercy. I use this language oftentimes, installments of mercy. And I quote a section from the Bhagavatam, 10th canto, chapter 88, where the first installment Krishna speaks of is removing all your material facilities so that you suffer and that no one likes you. There's the first installment because you ain't got any facility. And then the second installment is, all right, what to do? I got to take shelter of devotees. And then the third installment is you get prema finally. This is a set of three verses. I'm just glossing over it like this. So I think of mercy as installments. So the first installment of mercy is somehow or other you got sangha of devotees. The second installment is there's shraddha. The third installment is you accept the spiritual master and begin the process of bhajan kriya. And bhajan kriya takes, you got to learn what is the science of bhajan. And then the fourth installment of mercy is anartusko. The fifth installment is you become fixed. The sixth installment is you develop taste. The seventh installment is like this. So this is all mercy. Mercy can refer to all of the above. But if without having taken seriously one particular installment of mercy, how you can expect to get the next installment of mercy? It means that just like some sadhus have come, faith is coming, and you are neglecting that mercy that has come in your life. Looking for, you know, a guy look for the next mercy. Just like I had a friend, he was always asking our spiritual master about instructions. Guru Maharaj, do you have any instructions? And Guru Maharaj had given him 2-3 instructions, and he wasn't doing any of it. So he was talking to me one day and was like, Guru Maharaj is coming, I'm thinking to ask him for some instruction. I said, all right, Bubba, you're not even following the instructions he already gave. If you're not going to even follow what he's already gave, how do you expect more and more, you know, mercy? Mercy is already coming. You're neglecting it. You're throwing it on the side of the street and doing your own thing. So similarly, mercy is, the whole process is grace. You know, the beginning of the process, the middle of the process, and the final attainment, all three states are acts of grace from the Supreme Lord through his associates and various energies. But so then we should understand that science. In a sense, even mercy has a scientific understanding, devotional scientific understanding. And that's presented in literature such as Bhakti Rasamrita Sindhu, Bhakti Sandarbha, you know, Upadeshamrita, Bhajana Rahasya, Bhakti Notar. He wrote so many books describing the science. So without availing ourselves to that mercy, without availing ourselves to those vibrations, how can we demonstrate that we're actually eager for, let's say, the final mercy in the form of bhava, the final mercy in the form of prema? There should be some demonstration. Therefore, Krishna says these things in Gita. Those who develop love for me, Vidaraga Bhaya Krodha, Mahamaya Mamupasri, they take full shelter of me, giving up attachment, fear, and anger. Bahavo Gana Tapasa. And they accept this austerity of Gana Tapasa. Means hearing from the sadhu, essentially, and taking advantage of that mercy available. Sadhu is here. He knows the science more than I know. I don't know the science. And I need this scientific understanding. That's why our acharyas have gone through the pain. Srila Prabhupada has gone through the pain to carry, you know, a whole case of first cantos of the Bhagavatam. Why? To present the science of Krishna consciousness. And he writes in his preface, by knowing such a science, we will be able to defend ourselves against the onslaught of atheists and establish God as a concrete principle. Not only for others, but for ourselves. Because God may not be established as a concrete principle. We have so many doubts about that and so on. So how do you do it? By the science. So Prabhupada is taking the trouble, elderly man, to drag a big case of books. You know, one case of books comes, like, they're like, we have a big case of book outside. I'm like, and, you know, good luck with that. May the power be with you, Krishna Shakti. You know, I'm devoid of Krishna Shakti Vina Nahe. No picking up books. You know, my mentality. Anyway, that was slightly a joke, slightly reality. So Prabhupada is taking the trouble to take, why? To present the science. So no one can make claims to being eager for the mercy of the Lord without taking advantage of that mercy. Here's the beginning installment. Hear the Bhagavatam. I will not hear the Bhagavatam. I will do everything else. I will speculate. I'll give my own understanding because I heard a few stories here and there, and I'll just give understanding. You know, sometimes our opinions are just wrong because I don't know the actual science of Krishna consciousness. None of us wants to hear that, naturally. We happen to be conditioned souls. But sometimes you say, in my view, in my opinion, well, you might be wrong. And unless you can establish your view and opinion in terms of the science as painfully given by Srila Prabhupada and our acharyas, then if someone is able to do that, demonstrating that your point is not complete or perhaps it's even incorrect, then it would be more humble just to admit, oh, I was off on that particular point. I didn't know that. You know, I didn't know so many things. Instead of making, you know, trying to eclipse the whole thing by saying it's all mercy, it's bhakti, you know, Gan doesn't matter, this doesn't matter, that. I've been 12 years here and there traveling around. These are the types of things that I hear. I get frustrated. Of course, I personally protest certain things when this comes up for the purpose of clarifying what is the actual science. That part, which is mercy, you know, it's not like understanding the details of these things. That is their mercy also. Otherwise, they wouldn't have taken, they didn't have to write the books for themselves. It's not like Jiva Goswami was bored, so he decided to write 400,000 Sanskrit shlokas. Because then, you know, it didn't have anything better to do, so I decided to write, or Prabhupada was, you know, bored. Therefore, let me write Bhaktivedanta purports because, you know, I need some engagement, you know, otherwise Maya's going to get me. You know, not like that. They wrote for our benefit, so if we're not going to take advantage of that mercy, then we're just a show bottle. We're just making a claim of it's all mercy, grace, and this, that, but you don't hear the Bhagavatam, you don't study the Bhagavatam, neither you will accept someone who has done so as more authoritative than yourself. Then it is how you can make any claim to humility also. It is simply show bottle. So this is the whole path is grace, but there's an installments of grace are coming. And if you have, let's say, if we have proven ourselves, so to speak, or deemed ourselves worthy by taking seriously one installment of mercy, then the next installment, the next installment, the next installment, and carry on in Krishna consciousness in this way, like this. Jitendra wants to have a comment, then we have to close it out. I'm already over time. I thought I would get to the famous verses today. I was well on my way. Somehow this discussion arose.
We hear that the word mercy is not in the vocabulary of the impersonalist. you remember?
Maybe the Mayavadis, because they are aparadis. But Krishna describes as the impersonalist in chapter 12 of Bhagavad Gita as being kind to all souls. If you see 12.4 Bhagavad Gita, I think, 12.3.4 Bhagavad Gita, he describes the impersonalist there as being performing welfare work for all souls. So, making the distinction between Mayavadis and Brahmavadis. Brahmavadis are also filled with some mercy. Like this.
Great.
We just like to diss them so that we can keep everyone focused on pure devotion. Say, oh, the impersonalists are also good? Okay, well, maybe I'll check that out too. So to keep us focused, we just disparage anything that they're doing. That's the pure devotional mood. All right, then. Thank you all very much. Srila Prabhupada Ki Jai. 짧아야 돼.